Today is June 22, 2026. This is your geopolitics briefing for Briefing Desk. In the next 32 to 35 minutes, we'll cover Ukraine's sustained campaign to collapse Russian logistics into Crimea, now producing acute fuel and food shortages on the peninsula, and track the diplomatic fallout from the G7 summit, a stalled U.S.-Iran nuclear memorandum, and a Poland-Ukraine award dispute that Moscow has moved quickly to exploit. Let's start where the most immediate pressure is being applied, not on the front lines of eastern Ukraine, but on the supply lines running into occupied Crimea. The Institute for the Study of War, the American research institute that tracks military developments in the conflict, has confirmed that Ukraine's sustained strike campaign has produced severe degradation of Russian logistical routes into the peninsula. The Institute's assessment is that these strikes are complicating Russia's use of supply corridors between southwestern Russia and Crimea in ways that are now becoming operationally significant. The scale of what Ukraine has executed against those northern land crossings is striking in its precision and persistence. According to reporting on the campaign, Ukrainian forces struck every bridge connecting Crimea from the north on June 7th, June 9th, June 11th, and June 13th, destroying each crossing in sequence. Russian engineering units responded, as they typically do, with pontoon bridges. But pontoon infrastructure is inherently constraining. It forces vehicles into single-file, low-speed crossings. And once those crossings were established, they too were targeted. Then there is the Kerch Bridge, the primary overwater route into Crimea, spanning roughly 12 miles. That structure is currently operating at approximately 20% of its capacity, the result of at least three separate structural attacks over the course of the war. The first was a truck bomb roughly 2 years ago that dropped road spans and ignited fuel rail cars. The second was a surface drone strike approximately 2.5 years prior. The third, and the one that has attracted particular attention from military analysts, involved a subsurface unmanned vessel. What makes this attack historically notable is that it appears to represent the first instance in naval history of an unmanned submersible traveling more than 250 nautical miles to detonate approximately 1,000 pounds of TNT equivalent near the bridge's abutments. The engineering and operational complexity of executing that mission at that range is considerable. As for the two alternative land routes that bypass the bridge, they are reported to be operating at approximately 15% capacity and require a detour of roughly 480 miles. At that kind of diversion distance, you are not supplementing a supply chain, you are straining it to its operational limit. On June 11th, Ukrainian forces struck a bridge near occupied Armiansk, with approximately 50 trucks carrying fuel and ammunition reported destroyed in that single attack. Separately, Ukraine's medium-range Hornet strike drones have destroyed dozens of Russian military vehicles, fuel tankers, and bridges along the Novorossiya Highway, the main road artery linking Crimea northward through occupied Kherson, Zaporizhia, Donetsk, and Luhansk oblasts. Reporting by Kyiv Post correspondent Jason Smart, puts the total number of fuel and supply vehicles destroyed while traveling toward Crimea at over 200. And the ferry vessel Pangaea, which was carrying truck cargo across the Kerch Strait, was attacked by Ukrainian drones in the hours preceding one of the cited broadcasts. The cumulative effect of all this is a supply crisis that has now moved from the strategic layer down to the civilian and administrative layer on the peninsula itself. In Sevastopol, the occupation administration has introduced a QR code system for gasoline purchases and has reduced individual daily fuel limits from 20 liters per day down to 20 liters per week. That is a reduction of more than 85% in available consumer fuel allocation. Aksyonov, identified as the occupation authority governing Crimea, went further, ordering a complete halt to fuel sales to private citizens altogether, reserving remaining supply exclusively for state vehicles. Electricity to Crimea was described as fully cut as of the morning of one of the cited broadcasts. And Ukrainian assessments, corroborated across multiple sources, Place remaining food supplies on the peninsula at approximately 30 days, with purchase limits already introduced on sugar, flour, and grains. Commander of Ukraine's Unmanned Systems Forces, Robert Brody, stated that one of Ukraine's primary objectives is to isolate occupied Crimea and create conditions in which the presence of military personnel and defense workers in occupied territories becomes, in his words, extremely difficult. A growing number of analysts, according to reporting, assess these developments as a potential precursor to a Ukrainian amphibious landing attempt, though this remains speculative. What is notable is that even Russian propagandist Vladimir Solovyov publicly acknowledged on state media that the strikes on Crimea could be preparations for an amphibious landing, and called for active deployment of Russian engineering troops and coastal interception systems. When a figure typically associated with minimizing Ukrainian military capability is urging emergency defensive measures, that is itself a signal worth registering. The pressure on Crimea's logistics is the visible edge of a broader campaign against Russian energy infrastructure, one that has now reached a scale that is generating domestic economic stress inside Russia itself. Ukraine has struck Russian oil refineries 158 times in total. That includes 24 of Russia's 33 refineries capable of processing over 1 million tons of oil per year. At least 35 of those strikes occurred during 2026 alone. Reuters sources assessed that virtually all major oil refineries in central Russia have been forced to halt or scale back output, representing roughly a quarter of Russia's total refinery capacity. Named affected facilities include refineries in Tuapse, Perm, Kirishi, Ryazan, and Saratov. Reporting from Kyiv Post correspondent Jason Smart adds further detail. Facilities responsible for producing 40% of Moscow's gasoline and 50% of Moscow's diesel were struck. Strikes were also carried out in Siberia, at a range exceeding 2,000 kilometers from the front lines, a reach that illustrates how far Ukrainian long-range strike capacity has extended into Russian territory. Rowan Fondenstein, co-founder of the Brussels Freedom Hub, speaking to Channel 24, characterized the refinery campaign as serving three simultaneous purposes. First, creating domestic unease among Russian citizens who face fuel shortages and rising prices. Second, reducing Kremlin revenue by limiting oil product exports. And third, degrading the fuel available to Russian military forces at the operational level. Russian media has reported that at least 53 Russian regions, plus Russian-occupied areas of Ukraine, have begun imposing fuel limits, a geographic spread that indicates the shortage is not localized. Here is where the picture becomes more complicated. Despite the refinery damage, Russia's sea deliveries of crude oil reached an average of 3.46 million barrels per day in May 2026, a year-on-year increase of 120,000 barrels from 2025. Russia is exporting crude even as its domestic refining capacity contracts. At the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum, President Putin himself stated that the share of oil and gas revenues in Russia's economy had dropped from around 40% to 23% since 2022, describing this as no longer critically important.
The claim is an attempt to reframe dependency as diversification. Defense One's Tucker assessed that oil infrastructure deep in Russian territory is, in his framing, no longer safe, giving Kyiv leverage over Moscow's export revenues. The St. Petersburg Forum, which attracted more than 20,000 participants from 130 countries, was itself the target of a Ukrainian drone attack during the event. A Russian corvette identified as the Boyki was struck in dry dock at Kronstadt Island port, causing a fire and what is described as likely extensive damage. The St. Petersburg oil terminal also caught fire. Russian authorities attributed this to debris from a downed drone, stating it caused the deaths of two firefighters. Beyond the energy sector, broader economic stress indicators are accumulating. Russian parliamentary members have raised an 11 trillion ruble fiscal shortfall. ATM cash shortages have been reported across Moscow. Major Moscow banks lacked US dollars and euros during the May holidays. Construction firm bankruptcies are rising. And there are reports of the sale of undeveloped elite residential land, a category of asset that in normal economic conditions would be held rather than liquidated. The head of the Russian central bank, Nabiullina, faces government pressure to cut interest rates, despite inflation cited at over 20%, against a current rate of 14.5%. The pressure to cut rates to stimulate a war economy is running directly against the inflationary reality those cuts would worsen. Oil revenues constitute approximately 45% of the Russian national budget, making refinery damage not merely a military inconvenience, but a structural budget stress. Perhaps most telling is a detail about Russia's elite networks. The arrest of a major St. Petersburg port owner, said to control facilities through which approximately 86% of Russia's seaborne oil passes, has been described as a sign of stress within the elite circles surrounding Putin. Kirilo Budanov, described as former head of Ukrainian military intelligence and currently chief of staff to President Zelensky, stated that Russian elites are turning against the government and have begun reaching out to foreign intelligence operatives, including those of Ukraine and Western powers. A Russian businessman who attended the St. Petersburg Forum was characterized in one account as describing the information environment around Putin as isolated, with advisors not conveying the severity of domestic conditions. Assessments of the battlefield itself remain sharply divided, and the divergence between optimistic and pessimistic readings is itself a story worth examining directly. The Institute for the Study of War has asserted that Ukraine has seized the initiative, with Russia's average monthly territorial gains over the past 12 months at 108 square miles. That is a slower pace than earlier in the war, and the Institute frames it as evidence of Ukrainian operational resilience. However, the Pentagon Director General's May 2026 report stated Russia almost certainly retains a significant advantage over Ukraine in most key areas. And National Intelligence Director Tulsi Gabbard testified in March that the U.S. intelligence community believed Russia had, in her words, the upper hand in the conflict. These are not minor analytical differences. They reflect genuinely different assessments of trajectory. In Donetsk Oblast, Ukrainian military expert Konstantin Mashovets assessed the tactical prospects for defending Konstantinovka as very unfavorable for Ukrainian forces, with Russian forces controlling all but the northern portions of the city and an estimated 12,000 Ukrainian forces encircled. Ukrainian authorities have ordered evacuations of parts of Kramatorsk, Slovyansk, and several surrounding settlements. Ukrainian experts have also warned about the situation in Kazachya Lopan in Kharkiv Oblast, assessing that its capture would open a path toward Kharkiv's outskirts, a development that would represent a significant escalation of pressure on Ukraine's second-largest city. On the Russian side, casualty figures cited in commentary, though not attributed to named institutional sources, place Russian losses at 5,000 to 7,000 soldiers per week, with individual soldier life expectancy at the front described as 20 to 30 minutes. Russian unit combat effectiveness is described as operating at approximately 25% of expected capacity, with no Russian units in the Ukrainian theater at full manpower strength. Russian forces are described as having shifted from combined arms maneuver to small group infantry tactics following the failure of larger formations, a tactical adaptation that reflects manpower and coordination constraints rather than doctrinal choice. Ukraine faces its own manpower pressures. Newly appointed Ukrainian Defense Minister Mykhailo Fedorov stated in January that approximately 2 million Ukrainians are evading the draft and around 200,000 soldiers have deserted. Ukrainian Ombudsman Dmytro Lubinets stated that mobilization complaints increased 333-fold compared to 2022. Approximately 95,000 Ukrainians of military age entered Germany since the beginning of 2025, accounting for 60% of total Ukrainian citizens seeking refuge on German soil. Russia is estimated to hold a 1.5 to 5 to 1 manpower advantage depending on sector. On air defense, the arithmetic is stark. Russia is estimated to produce up to 113 ballistic, aeroballistic, and hypersonic missiles per month. Lockheed Martin manufactures approximately 52 PAC-3 MSE interceptor missiles monthly. President Zelensky sent an open letter to President Trump in May urgently requesting PAC-3 and PAC-2 missiles for the Patriot system and a manufacturing license for Ukraine. Kharkiv Mayor Igor Terekhov reported more than 20 Garand-type drone strikes within Kharkiv city limits on June 10 alone, causing multiple fires. Ukraine's response to its own missile deficit has been developing on the indigenous production front. Ukraine has developed cruise missiles with a stated range exceeding 2,000 kilometers, with President Zelensky citing a potential range of up to 3,000 kilometers, a claim corroborated across multiple sources. Germany is reportedly examining the purchase of the Ukrainian Flamingo Fluorine Monophosphide 5 cruise missile. And in what analysts described as a special operations mission, Ukraine struck a rail tunnel connecting Russia and China. President Zelensky also issued a direct warning to Belarus, dismantle relay and communications infrastructure supporting Russian drone operations within 1 week, or face Ukrainian action to destroy it. One analysis estimated that Belarusian forces entering offensive operations could sustain upwards of 2,000 casualties per day, projecting 60,000 casualties within 4 weeks of engagement, a projection clearly intended to underscore the cost of Minsk committing fully to the Russian side. One of the less discussed but potentially significant capability stories of this war is what has been happening to Russia's airborne early warning and control aircraft, a campaign of attrition that has been underway for more than 3 years and is now measurably degrading a critical Russian capability. The aircraft at the center of this is the Bereav A-50, Russia's principal airborne early warning and control platform. To understand its importance, consider its capabilities. Detecting aerial targets at up to 650 kilometers and ground targets at up to 300 kilometers. Each unit is priced at approximately $350 million. Russia's Center for Analysis of Strategies and Technologies assessed that no more than 4 A-50s are available to Russian forces at any given time, against a starting inventory of 8 modernized A-50U models at the conflict's outset. The chronology of confirmed incidents paints a picture of systematic campaign, not opportunistic strikes. On February 26, 2023, a drone attack damaged an A-50 near Minsk, later attributed to the Ukrainian security service. That aircraft never returned to service. In January 2024, a second A-50 was shot down over the Sea of Azov, after Ukraine deliberately disabled Russian radar stations across Crimea in the preceding weeks, a sequenced operation that created the conditions for the kill. On February 23, 2024, a third A-50 was eliminated over the Sea of Azov using a Soviet-era S-200 missile system, with 10 Russian personnel killed, including several high-ranking officers. Building on that, in early March 2024, Ukraine struck the Taganrog aircraft plant, the known A-50 repair site, effectively targeting the maintenance infrastructure rather than just the aircraft. In June 2025, Operation Spiderweb struck two A-50s simultaneously, with satellite imagery confirming serious damage to both aircraft's radar rotodomes. In November 2025, a second strike on Taganrog using missile drones and Neptune cruise missiles involved a coordinated multi-service effort drawing on rocket forces and artillery, special operations forces, Navy coastal missile units, and unmanned systems forces. That same month, Ukraine also claimed destruction of the A-100 prototype, the intended successor to the A-50, and in March of 2026, a strike on the 123rd Aircraft Repair Plant in Staraya Russa in the Novgorod region was confirmed by the Ukrainian General Staff via telegram on March 20, stating that an A-50 was hit during maintenance. Russia's replacement program for the A-50 has stalled. The A-100, which had its initial flight in 2017, has not progressed beyond the prototype stage. Leaked files, attributed to manufacturer Bereav, indicate Russia has explored a hybrid surveillance platform based on the B-200 amphibious jet, but lacks the necessary engines, which are manufactured in Ukraine. The Kremlin has discussed recommencing A-50 production but has not done so, with economic constraints cited as a limiting factor. What this means operationally is a progressive degradation of Russia's ability to conduct integrated air battle management at the ranges its doctrine requires. Fewer available platforms, damaged repair infrastructure, and no viable near-term replacement program combine to create a capability gap that is difficult to close quickly. On the Ukrainian side, in a related development, Ukraine signed an agreement with Sweden in October 2025 for up to 150 Saab JAS-39 Gripen fighters. On February 11, 2026, Ukraine announced plans to allocate part of an EU support fund toward Gripen procurement. President Zelensky confirmed on April 17, 2026, that pilot training had begun and would expand in autumn 2026. A Defense Express analysis cited the key operational objective for the Gripen as pushing Russian Su-34 strike aircraft, the platforms carrying guided bombs against Ukrainian positions, farther from the front line, reducing their accuracy and increasing their exposure. Now to the diplomatic track, where the week's most significant headline was G7 unanimity on Ukraine, and where that unanimity sits alongside considerable uncertainty about follow-through. All 27 EU member states approved conclusions on Ukraine at a summit, the first unanimous agreement of this kind since March 2025. G7 leaders issued a statement signed by all heads of state and government affirming that Ukraine must have what it needs to remain strong. NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte used that specific formulation. Licensed weapons production in Ukraine under both American and European licenses was affirmed as part of the G7 outcome, a provision with practical significance for Ukraine's longer-term industrial capacity. The assessment from Frankfurt of Trump's posture at the summit was that he characterized Ukraine as a European problem rather than an American one. That position is described as unlikely to change materially. However, the unanimity of G7 support was characterized as the meeting's most significant outcome, a baseline commitment that holds even amid questions about American strategic direction. Fondenstein, speaking from Brussels, noted that Trump signed a G7 document committing to increased sanctions pressure on Russia, but expressed uncertainty about whether concrete measures would follow, given that waivers on certain energy-related sanctions connected to Iran remain in place. The summit was also marked by visible tensions. A public dispute emerged between Trump and Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni. Trump stated Meloni had sought to be photographed with him. Meloni denied the account and stated she regrets that Trump speaks worse of allies than of adversaries of the West. Italian Foreign Minister Antonio Tajani canceled a planned visit to Miami in apparent response. Tensions between Trump and German Chancellor Friedrich Merz were also noted, and French President Macron posted a G7 summary video juxtaposing Trump with footage of a French UFC fighter on the same evening as Trump's 80th birthday celebration. Trump arrived nearly an hour late to one of the G7 sessions, a detail noted across multiple accounts of the meeting. These interpersonal and symbolic frictions matter less than policy outcomes, but they are not entirely disconnected. The tone of allied relationships shapes the speed and cohesion of practical cooperation, particularly on sanctions enforcement and military aid channels. On Iran, the picture is one of process under strain. Planned U.S.-Iran talks in Switzerland were canceled. The Swiss Foreign Ministry announced the postponement of negotiations intended to produce a comprehensive nuclear agreement. J.D. Vance did not travel to Switzerland. The Iranian delegation's absence was attributed to Israeli ceasefire violations in Lebanon. A memorandum of understanding, referred to as the Islamabad Memorandum despite having been signed in Versailles, was signed by the United States and Iran. The document contains 14 points, with the first article declaring an immediate and definitive ceasefire on all fronts, including Lebanon. Israel is not a signatory, and Israeli officials stated they are not bound by it. The memorandum sets a 60-day deadline for a comprehensive agreement with an option to extend. That timeline was met with skepticism, with the observation that the prior JCPOA required approximately 2 years of negotiation. A 60-day window for a comprehensive nuclear agreement with a party that has been in active confrontation with U.S.-aligned states is, by historical standards, extremely compressed. On the Russia-Ukraine diplomatic track, U.S. envoy Steve Witkoff's reported return to Moscow was described as apparently aimed at pressuring Ukraine into withdrawing from areas of Donbas it currently holds. A Trump-Putin phone call of over 1 hour on Trump's Sunday birthday was described as having reinforced Trump's inclination to press Ukraine on Donbas. Bloomberg sources reported that European Council President Antonio Costa is attempting to establish a secret channel with the Kremlin, though Fondenstein stated he cannot imagine 27-member EU consensus on such a mandate. More directly, French President Macron stated that a summit between Trump and Putin took place in Anchorage, and that an agreement nearly reached at that meeting would have handed over Ukrainian territory not yet conquered by Russia. Macron stated that Trump initially believed Ukraine was going to lose, and that a European delegation traveled to Washington to present ground realities. Macron further stated Trump eventually concluded Russia does not honor its commitments. Russian negotiators are now actively using the phrase the spirit of Anchorage to signal what Moscow seeks to achieve, which is to say, they are invoking an agreement framework that would have awarded them territory they have not militarily secured. The financial picture underlying all of this diplomacy is stark. The Kiel Institute for the World Economy reported that European financial and humanitarian aid allocations dropped to less than one-fifth of the 2025 average monthly level between January and April 2026. Ukraine is described as spending 100% of government revenues on the war and is entirely dependent on foreign aid and loans for salaries and pensions. An additional 90 billion euros in EU support is described as already deemed insufficient. A bilateral dispute that might under other circumstances be a minor diplomatic irritant has taken on disproportionate significance because of the speed and clarity with which Moscow moved to exploit it. Polish President Andrzej Duda announced his intention to revoke the Order of the White Eagle from President Zelensky, citing Zelensky's consent to naming a Ukrainian Armed Forces unit after UPA historical figures. The UPA, the Ukrainian Insurgent Army, carried out massacres of Polish civilians during World War II, and its commemoration remains one of the most sensitive fault lines in Polish-Ukrainian historical memory. Duda stated Poland would block EU accession for any nation failing to distance itself from what he described as a cult of totalitarianism and violence. He reaffirmed Russia as the clear aggressor and characterized Putin as responsible for Europe's largest military conflict since World War II. So this is not a pro-Russian action in intent. But intent and effect can diverge. Polish media reports indicate the decision is not yet final, formally requiring the signature of Prime Minister Donald Tusk. Tusk's response is telling. He expressed deep regret, warned explicitly that deepening the bilateral dispute serves Putin's interests, and stopped short of confirming whether he would provide the mandatory procedural signature. Polish Foreign Minister Radoslaw Sikorski went further. He publicly highlighted a post from Russian Security Council Deputy Chairman Dmitry Medvedev, who praised the potential revocation. Sikorski's message to Duda, posted on the platform X, pointedly noted that Medvedev had supported the president's action. Medvedev used the occasion to publish personal insults against Zelensky on social media. The Institute for the Study of War's broader assessment that the Kremlin is actively setting informational conditions to justify continued strikes against Ukraine contextualizes Medvedev's swift and enthusiastic reaction as precisely the dynamic Tusk was warning against. When a Kremlin official praises a Polish domestic decision within hours, that is not coincidence. It is an information operation taking advantage of an opening. Ukraine's response was rapid and coordinated across three senior officials within a 24-hour window. Ukrainian Foreign Minister Andriy Sybiha rejected his commander's cross with Star of the Order of Merit of the Republic of Poland. On June 12, Kyello Budanov, head of the Ukrainian presidential office, formally declined his Gold Cross of Merit, describing Duda's decision as an unfriendly act and a gift to the Russian aggressor. Budanov also noted, in a pointed historical observation, that the Order of the White Eagle has not been revoked from Benito Mussolini. Ukraine's ambassador to Poland, Vasil Bodnar, also returned his Knight's Cross of the Order of Merit, making three senior Ukrainian officials to formally reject Polish state awards in rapid succession. The practical stakes here extend beyond symbolism. Duda's threat to block EU accession for Ukraine, if carried through, would have structural consequences for the diplomatic framework underpinning Ukrainian wartime solidarity with Europe. Whether that threat is credible, and whether Tusk's procedural role gives him the ability to contain the damage, are the two questions this story will turn on in the coming weeks. Shifting geographic registers significantly, to South Asia, where a treaty that has structured water rights between India and Pakistan for more than six decades is now formally in abeyance. India's decision to hold the Indus Waters Treaty in abeyance was described as a direct consequence of the April 22, 2025 Pahalgam attack, in which 26 civilians were killed. The legal basis cited for suspension is Article 62 of the Vienna Convention, which provides grounds for treaty suspension under fundamentally changed circumstances. To understand what this means, it helps to grasp the underlying allocations. The total yield of the Indus River system is approximately 168 to 170 million acre-feet. Under the 1960 treaty, India was allocated 33 million acre-feet of that total. Of that Indian allocation, 5 to 6 million acre-feet flows onward to Pakistan, leaving India utilizing approximately 26 to 27 million acre-feet. India also paid Pakistan £6.206 million pounds sterling between 1960 and 1970 under Article 5 of the treaty for Pakistani infrastructure construction, equivalent to approximately 50 billion Indian rupees in current terms. A Danish Hydraulic Institute study from April 2019, prepared for the Jammu and Kashmir State Power Corporation, found annual losses to Jammu and Kashmir of $386 million, yielding approximately $506 million, roughly 4.8 billion Indian rupees annually in current values. The same study found that of a total cultivatable area of 17,519 square kilometers in Jammu and Kashmir, only 6,318 square kilometers had been irrigated, leaving over 11,273 square kilometers unirrigated, attributed in part to treaty restrictions on Indian water use. The allocation asymmetry that Sharma describes is significant. India, holding approximately 52% of undivided Punjab's 358,000 square kilometers, receives 19% of the water. Pakistan, holding approximately 58% of the area, receives 81% of the water. Of 143 canals in combined Punjab, only 12 are in India and 131 are in Pakistan. India is permitted only 3.6 million acre-feet of storage on western rivers against combined eastern river storage exceeding 17 million acre-feet across three major dams, Ranjit Sagar, Bakra on the Sutlej, and Pong on the Bees. On the question of flood weaponization, a Pakistani concern that India might use dam releases as a weapon, Sharma disputed this directly, stating that any release from Tin Dam would first inundate approximately 80 kilometers of Indian territory before reaching Pakistan, and that approximately 50 kilometers of Indian territory lies between Salal Dam on the Chenab and the Pakistani border. He also noted that India has held more than 17 million acre-feet of Eastern River storage since 1963 without using it to flood Pakistan, a 60-plus year record he characterized as evidence of restraint. The important caveat to note on this segment, no Pakistani government position, international arbitral body, or third-party institutional voice is represented in the source material. The analysis here reflects one perspective on a bilateral dispute with significant contested dimensions. Finally, a look at how Ukraine is developing and deploying autonomous systems, both as a current operational tool and as an indicator of where this conflict is taking military technology more broadly. Ukraine has deployed the Palantir Prisma platform within its main intelligence directorate and other strike units. Prisma is described as aggregating real-time data from drones, radar intercepts, and satellite imagery to coordinate mass drone strikes, functioning as an integration layer that translates sensor inputs from multiple sources into targeting outputs. This is the kind of software infrastructure that enables the volume and precision of strike operations Ukraine has been executing against logistics corridors and refinery facilities. On the ground robotics side, Ukrainian ground robots are reported to perform 80% of logistics tasks on front lines. A single remote-controlled droid TW-12.7 robot held a position for 45 days during the summer of 2025, with a third Army Corps spokesperson quoted as stating the robot and its operator, approximately 6.2 miles away, disrupted every attempted breakthrough and prevented enemy infiltration with no Ukrainian casualties. That is a 45-day defensive action with zero personnel loss, enabled by remote operation and sustained endurance. Two Phantom MK1 humanoid robots were transferred to Ukraine for testing in February 2026, primarily for logistics in hazardous areas. The current platform has a payload capacity of approximately 44 pounds, with no waterproofing and insufficient battery endurance for large-scale use. The U.S. Manufacturer Foundation plans to send an upgraded Phantom 2 with double the payload capacity later in 2026. On precision munitions, the Ukrainian company The Fourth Law's TFL-1 module is described as making a drone four times more likely to hit its target, a manufacturer's claim, but one that, if accurate, represents a significant multiplier on existing drone inventories. David Aloyan, Deputy Secretary of Ukraine's National Security and Defense Council, described plans for a distributed air defense network that would eventually require only approximately 10 human operators to approve interceptions, effectively automating the detection, tracking, and engagement sequence down to a human approval step at the final decision point. His stated definition of victory is leaving Russia much weaker so it cannot rearm, noting Russia is currently directing approximately 30% of its economy toward defense. A broader statistic cited in commentary, though not attributed to a named institutional source, places Russian military logistics trucks destroyed over the course of the war at 150,000, alongside 12,000 Russian tanks destroyed. The commentary framed the truck figure as exceeding the combined military vehicle inventories of all European NATO members in a 72-hour operational scenario. These figures, because they lack institutional attribution, should be treated as illustrative rather than definitive, but they point toward the scale of material attrition that has characterized this conflict on the Russian side. That is the picture as it stands on June 22, 2026. Crimea is under logistical siege, with acute civilian and military shortages now confirmed. Russia's domestic economic indicators are under growing strain from a combination of refinery strikes, fiscal shortfalls, and elite network stress. The battlefield assessment remains contested between institutions, with Ukrainian territory losses in Donetsk coexisting with significant Russian capability degradation. G7 unanimity on Ukraine was achieved, but its translation into concrete measures remains uncertain. The Iran nuclear memorandum faces a 60-day deadline that analysts describe as unrealistic, and a Polish-Ukrainian historical dispute has been rapidly absorbed into the Kremlin's information campaign. This has been your geopolitics briefing from Briefing Desk. We will be back with the next edition as developments warrant. That's your core brief for today. Thanks for listening. We'll be back tomorrow with more.